You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Hey everyone, welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 34. It's just me today, and I have guest Chris Williamson, who's producing the Chasing Earhart documentary about Amelia Earhart, and it's everything about Amelia Earhart from her life on through her flying career, and then of course the disappearance and the search for Amelia Earhart and what might have happened to her. So sit back, listen to this fun and entertaining show, and go check out Chasing Earhart online. Check out the links in the show notes. All right, welcome to the Archaeology Show. April could not join me today, my co-host, but that's no problem because I have on with me today my guest, and it is Chris Williamson. Chris, how's it going?
It's going well. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. So Chris Williamson is on to talk about the Chasing Earhart project and his interest in Amelia Earhart. And we first actually had an Amelia Earhart podcast, and I'll link to this in the show notes. It was back in early fall 2017. We interviewed Tom King, who was one of the principal archaeologists on the TIGAR project that was out doing their, I think it's their biannual digs or excavations and research out at Nikumaroro Island. I think I'm saying that right.
Yep.
Where they think Amelia Earhart actually landed and possibly landed, and then you know, her and Fred Noonan passed away there for whatever reason. So they don't know any much about that yet. But we'll get into that later. Let's talk right now though about if we have time.
Sure. Yeah, that's a big question.
Exactly. So, Chris, why don't you tell everybody just a little bit about yourself, and then we'll talk about Chasing Earhart. So how did you come to all this? What led you to this path?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. It seems to be, I always tell people, third grade seems to be kind of like the magic year, the magic time for people to get introduced to Amelia Earhart. And for me, it's really no different. I was doing a History Day project when I was in third grade, and I remember our teacher put up a bunch of 8x10s around the room and of all these famous Americans. And you had Lincoln and Washington, and you had Harriet Tubman and Martin Luther King and all those folks. and then you had Amelia Earhart. And at the time I didn't know who she was, but it was, the famous bomber jacket photo, I should say, for with her hands and her hips that everybody's probably seen. If you Google Amelia Earhart, you'll see it. And, so I decided to go ahead and just, you know, pick her after a couple of days, no one had picked her. And that sort of became my unofficial involvement. I just kind of fell in love with the person she was and what she stood for and all this incredible stuff. Even at a young age, I was just kind of fascinated with it. And I remember I kept kind of sort of going back to that well. And every year when History Day project came around or it was time to do that, I would just kind of revisit Amelia Earhart. I would do another project on her, and I would kind of focus on a different aspect of her life and of her career. And all the way up to, you know, college, and I would write my papers on her, and I would do all these things. So she kind of was always a staple for me in my life, and unofficially. And then officially, about 9 years ago, I started doing pre-research on a project that at the time had no structure, had no scope or anything like that. I just kind of knew that I wanted to do some kind of Amelia Earhart project. I didn't really know what it was going to be, but I did know that I wanted to talk to as many folks as I possibly could. That's really kind of all I knew. That was the original kind of spark idea. And then, back in, I think I want to say it was 2013 sometime, I decided that, you know, I wanted to do podcasting as a forum, as a platform for it. Because at the time, podcasting, as you know, had really exploded onto the scene. A lot of people were really doing podcasting, and it was kind of a newer form of a newer medium. And really anybody could do it if they had a passion and a drive for it. And I thought, you know, you combine that, couple that with the fact that there wasn't any dedicated Amelia Earhart podcast out there. There were several one-off episodes, but there was nothing out there like what we were going to attempt. And so that's kind of how it was born. And it always kind of started with the podcast. And then, of course, we added the documentary, which kind of took everything to a whole nother level. But the original idea was just the podcast itself. And here we are. That's kind of the genesis of what would become Chasing Earhart.
So the Chasing Earhart documentary, we're linking to this stuff in the show notes as well. Before we talk about that, do you have a background in like documentary filmmaking or filmmaking at all? Or is this something you just said, you know, let's just do this?
Well, I've always been passionate about film. Ever since I was little, I remember doing, you know, recording our own videos and making our own movies and things like that with my cousin, who was a kind of like my best friend in my life. And, you know, we'd always do that stuff. And I never really had a professional background in it. I'd always kind of dabbled in editing and audio engineering and things like that. Nothing too hardcore. My background is primarily information technology, and that's really kind of what our team has a strong background in various aspects of IT. So, and we've kind of turned that into a benefit for the project, but I've never had personally any really detailed experience in documentary filmmaking. But luckily, fortunately for me, I was blessed to know people that just started coming out of the woodwork that were sound engineers and, sound people and, DPs and, people that had experience on documentary filmmaking. And once they kind of saw the vision I had and saw what I wanted to do, they kind of lended their services out of passion. And so it's been a really kind of a neat process, we've learned a lot since March. We just started shooting the documentary in March. So it's been
nice.
We packed so much into those few months. It's coming up on a year now that we'll be shooting the documentary. We've already got almost 200 hours of documentary. So we've got a lot of footage and, it's just been an incredible experience so far. So no official background, but Earhart was always going to be the one. We founded a 501c3 Chris Evan Films, which is, I always get asked, is that, based off Chris Evans, the actor? And it's like, no, it's not. It just happens to be my first name and my son's first name. And so we thought it'd be kind of a good way to kind of be an honor to my son to do this, because he's 8 years old and he's going with us on all this adventure. And it's been a lot of fun. So hence Chris Evan Films was born. And Chasing Earhart is the very first project of Chris Evan Films.
All right, great. Well, I think that's just to put that note out there. There's a lot of people, I know a ton of people that just like, they have a dream and a passion about something. They're like, well, I don't have the skill to do this, or I don't have the, the money to do this or the something, but just push forward with it, tell people about it, and you might be surprised.
Yeah.
I'm glad you decided to just do it. Even you like never made a documentary series before, let alone not just one documentary, but let alone a series of documentaries, and said, let's just go big or go home on this and get it done.
Yeah, definitely. I would agree with you. It's skill is almost, I don't want to say skill is irrelevant, but I think passion is more important than skill, and love and drive for something. If you really want to do something, right, you'll learn the skill to do it. You'll work on it. You'll put in the time and the effort. Passion drives you at 1 o'clock in the morning when you're dead tired. And you know this more than anybody. I'm preaching to the choir here, but when you love what you do, passion drives you. It's not the skill, it's the passion that drives you. And I would agree with that comment. It's very, very relevant. It's passion is a big deal. And we really have that by the boatload at Chasing Earhart for sure.
Yeah, a couple of my podcasts are coming up on 5 and 6 year anniversaries.
Wow,
and awesome. I'll tell you what, it's definitely not skill. So go listen to those first episodes. You know exactly what I'm talking
same
about.
Same here, man. Same here. I'm in the same boat. Yeah. It's interesting. You mentioned Tom King earlier. Tom King was gracious enough to be our inaugural guest on the podcast. He's a good friend of the project.
Nice.
And, Tom was wonderful, but my first episode was just cringeworthy for me. It was just, I was so nervous to talk to someone of that stature, because he's such a, and you and I have talked about this off the air, but Tom King he's a rock star when it comes to archaeology, and he's very humble about it.
Absolutely.
But he's pretty much the guy when it comes to archaeology, and to have someone of that stature be the first one out of the gate for Chasing Earhart it was a real blessing for us, and we're just real excited to have him, and he's become a good friend, and we're actually going to have him back on the show this coming Saturday. Him and Andrew McKenna are going to do a recap with us on the latest trip out to Nicomororo, which if I remember correctly, was Tom's swan song. In our episode, he said that was going to be his last trip. He wasn't going to go back out. We'll see. So we'll see if he changes mind or not. We'll find out on Saturday.
Yeah. It's funny you say that about him being the first interview you did, because my CRM archaeology podcast, the one about my industry, he was like interview 3 or 4. We didn't actually intend to start out being an interview show. I just happened to ask him, because he's all over Facebook. He's really engaged over there. And I just happened to ask him, say, hey, Tom, would you mind coming on? And he's like, yeah, no problem. So we figured it out. And he was actually, I think, our first interview, not quite our first podcast, but definitely our first interview. So yeah, it's really cool that he does that.
Yeah. Great guy. Very humble.
Yeah. So let's talk about Chasing Earhart and Amelia Earhart a little more. So we already talked about how you got interested in Amelia Earhart. I'm interested in the documentary. I think I've heard some, and we'll get you to say this, but I think I've heard some details on what format you want the documentary, how many parts it's going to be, but you've got over 200 hours of already filmed material. So has what the documentary is going to be changed at all in your mind? Are you still shooting for, first tell everybody what's the what are you producing? You know,
yeah.
How many parts to this?
It's a good question. It's a very basic but very good question. You know, it's what we're doing is we understood early on because this is really the largest. Chasing Earhart is the largest scale size Amelia Earhart project ever put out, hands down. There's mm-hmm. no documentary out there that's going to even touch as far as the length and the complexity and the detail of the project that we're doing. So we knew right off the bat when we first had our first business meetings about it that we couldn't possibly do this as a 2-hour documentary. It just wouldn't physically be possible. We thought, you know, in coupling that with trying to think outside the box of you know, how can we make a documentary program that's going to stand out and that's going to be different? Because anybody who's has seen at least a half a dozen Earhart documentaries in their lifetime already, it's a flooded market. It really is. Mm-hmm. And so we came up with the idea of doing a documentary series, which has never been done. And we thought, well, what's the magic number? Like, what can we do that's going to make it, you know, applicable for what we're trying to do? And we came up with 14, and we're toying with a 15th hour right now. So it's possibly that it might end up being finalized at 15, but as it stands, it's going to be a 14 part episodic series. It's going to be about 45 minutes to an hour, depending if it gets distributed by a big distributor, if it gets released grassroots style. If it does get released grassroots style, it'll probably be closer to an hour each episode. People can binge watch it. We'll probably release the entire documentary at once. That's still kind of up for debate, but we're kind of deciding what we want to do there. And the idea is to really kind of do different episodes. Every episode is going to have a different tone. We're going to be talking a lot about Amelia Earhart as a child and how she was, you know, because for what we're trying to do, you really have to go from the cradle to the disappearance. And so we're going to be talking about, you know, the kind of young girl that she was growing up in Atchison and you know, kind of the things that she experienced in Atchison and the experiences that she had that really, unbeknownst to her, planted the seeds of who she'd become and what she would do with her life. And we're also going to devote one episode of the documentary to every major hypothesis. And so what we're going to do is we're going to have Tiger's going to have their own episode of the documentary that's strictly 100% Tiger and their research. We're going to be interviewing a lot of the main players in that. Tom would be included in that. Also, the Japanese capture hypothesis is going to get its due. We're going to really talk to a lot of the main players in that, which we've already had on the show, on the podcast, rather. And, you know, the Irene Bolam case, which is a really fascinating aspect of the Amelia Earhart lore and kind of the research investigation. We're going to be dedicating some time to that. That hasn't really been had the spotlight shown on it as much as it should be. And, of course, Crash and Sink, which is the most common, you know, hypothesis for what happened. Occam's razor, you know, the simplest explanation is often the most correct one or the most accurate one. So we're going to be dedicating a lot of that, but we're also going to be dedicating an episode to Fred Noonan, who largely gets, you know, lost in all this. He was one of the best navigators of all time. And, you know, there was a mm-hmm. second person on that plane. You know, he went with her when a lot of people bailed on her. So she, you know, they had a really good relationship professionally, and he believed in her and believed in the world flight. So we're going to talk to Fred Noonan's extended family and some people that are experts in celestial navigation and get their opinions on it. And we're also doing an episode dedicated to Muriel Earhart, who was Amelia Earhart's sister, who, you know, really kind of went the other way in her life. But it was kind of a fascinating kind of, you know, way to look at it, where one sister went one way privately and one sister went into the stratosphere, you know, as far as a celebrity was concerned. And then, of course, we're going to do an episode dedicated to George Putnam, who many people believe, including myself, if there wasn't a George Putnam, there would be no Amelia Earhart, at least not to the tone that we talk about her now. He really did help her. They were really a fantastic team. So we have a lot to make up in the documentary series, and we're going to be coming up with some more stuff as well. But it's exciting. It's kind of a big deal for us as far as what we're trying to do. And it's just kind of one aspect of Chasing Earhart. So the documentary will hopefully drop in fall of 2019. Unless it gets picked up, and then at that point, the distributor will determine when it's going to release. But if we release it on our own, it'll be fall of 2019. That's what we're shooting for right now.
Okay, and I like the idea of kind of dropping it Netflix style all at once. People love to binge things these days.
Yeah, we figured as much.
Yeah, and it would be a great series to do that with, because it's not, like you said, just a one-off. You're really going from, you know, from cradle to grave, as they say, you know, her entire life. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, crafting the episodes just right, just kind of almost leaving a cliffhanger at the end of one. Just, I need to watch that next one and find out what's going on, what's happening, what's the next stage of her life, right? You know, how's this working?
Exactly.
So I like that thought a lot. Also, you know what, I actually had a lot of questions based on how you were doing that. And I'm glad you just went into that, because it's a great thing to do. Too many topics in our world these days end up just with a 45 minute kind of thing. And then you end up glossing over the details, and you don't really get into the real meat of the details like you guys are. And I like that. So let's talk about Amelia Earhart a little bit specifically. I want to, because we are kind of glossing over the details, it's kind of short show like this compared to what you're doing. So we're going to kind of hit the sure. high points, but I want to talk about a lot of, I don't think there's anyone that doesn't know who Amelia Earhart yeah. is. But and a lot of people know that she was a pilot, that she disappeared. We don't know what happened to her, but maybe let's just cover some of the high points. What was she on that flight for? What was the purpose of this flight that she was on? What was she trying to achieve or accomplish?
Well, you know, the world flights had been achieved at the time. She wasn't the first one to attempt a world flight, certainly, but she wanted to do it bigger and better than anybody else. Mm-hmm. That was just kind of the drive that she had. So she wanted to circumnavigate the globe equatorially. So she wanted to get as close as she possibly could to the equator in her route, which means she would cover the most ground that anyone had ever covered. And it would be the longest mm-hmm. flight, basically, because, you know, you're going around the world at the center of the world. So it takes a lot longer. You know, this was something that she just felt like everything else in her life. She just felt she had to do it. And it was one of those things that, you know, it's really the same reason why she did the transatlantic flight. You know, when she did the, you know, the first attempt when she was famously quoted herself as a sack of potatoes, she wanted to do it on her own the next time because she just felt she had to do it. And the world flight was going to really be sort of her swan song. It was going to be, you know, her last kind of major flight. I think if she had finished the flight, she was probably going to be pretty set as far as her celebrity was concerned. Not that she wasn't already, but, you know, she could have opened up a flight school. There was rumor and innuendo that she was going to open up a flight school and that she was going to kind of get into all that and just start teaching and start getting deeper into her role at Purdue, which she had been doing at the time as far as advising and kind of taking that role up with kind of being a mentor to young women that were attending school at Purdue. But she was really on the flight because she wanted to kind of put a really nice ribbon, a nice bow on her career. Really, she had done everything she had done everything that you could possibly do. She had broken multiple world records. Some of those records were her own that were previously set by her. There was nothing left for her to do. And when there's nothing left for you to do in your field, you know, you exit stage left, you know, you've done everything. And she thought this would be a fantastic way to just kind of look at, you know, put a cap on her career and then move on to the next stage in her life, possibly have kids. You know, they just bought a house in Toluca Lake, her and GP. And so they beautiful house. We've been to it. It's pretty incredible. You know, she was possibly going to open up a flight school, you know, World War. It's really interesting what would have taken place. We've kind of speculated with this with a lot of our guests. World War II obviously broke out 7 years after she disappeared. Or actually, I'm sorry, 5 years after she disappeared. She disappeared in 37. World War II broke out in, well, 41, I guess, is when it was. So, you know, what's interesting to see is when World War I kind of occurs, you know, the draft happens, all the men get taken in the draft, and who steps up to run the country but women? And I think she would have really been a massive advocate for that. She would have, that would have maybe changed her plans. You know, and then, of course, the WASPs were formed. And who knows if she would have done something with that. I mean, really, it's kind of interesting to see kind of what she would have done. I mean, she was 39 years old at the time that she disappeared. So, you know, a lot of people, this is a woman who walked away from 11 crashes at the time she disappeared. So, you know, she was pretty incredible. But who knows what she would have done with her career afterwards. But, you know, to kind of circle back to that question of why she was on it, I think she was on it because she wanted to cap her career. She wanted to put a nice ribbon on it. This was the very biggest and best way you could possibly do that. And that was kind of how she was. She was a really go big or go home kind of girl. And she was just going to put it out there. Mm-hmm. And she fully knew the risks when she attempted this world flight. She fully knew that there was a possibility that she couldn't make it. She fully knew that they had to land on Howland Island, which was like literally a floating needle in a haystack. You know, she knew everything that she knew, and she still wanted to do it. And I think that just gives a kind of a testament of the kind of woman she was, that she famously kind of said before the flight that I had, you know, thought about not return, the possibility of not returning. And once I thought about it and gave it its due, there really was no attention. There was no reason to really return to it. It was thought about. She decided to push forward, and that was that. And I think it was all just to put a cap on her career.
She definitely didn't miss the mark on becoming a celebrity because she's almost probably more famous because she disappeared now. Who's to say what she would have done in her life? Cause she saw a lot incredible. Of life left in her, but
yeah, it really is.
It's amazing. Yeah. So, okay, well, we're going to take our first break. And when we come back, we'll dive a little deeper into this story. In the meantime, go over to arcpodnet.com/members to help support the Archaeology Podcast Network and this show and our efforts with public archaeology and outreach. Back in a minute.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to arcpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to arcpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
All right, we're back on the Archaeology Show, and we're talking with Chris Williamson of Chasing Earhart, the documentary that's coming to you hopefully sometime in the next, well, sometime by fall of 2019.
Yeah.
See who picks it up.
One day.
Yeah. And so, you know, we talked a little bit about the motivations behind the projects, and we're getting into Amelia Earhart a little bit. I wanted to mention too, I'm in the Civil Air Patrol, and
oh, cool.
The as you probably know, but a lot of the listeners may not know, Amelia Earhart actually features pretty prominently in the Civil Air Patrol because she's one of the major. The Earhart Award is one of the major achievements that cadets in the Civil Air Patrol achieve throughout their career.
Yeah, so it's incredible, isn't it? It really is. The reach is ridiculous.
It is. And we were talking about her, like her celebrity, basically, before we went to the break. And I just made a quick comment, but I want to kind of dive into that a little more because it's, I mean, you know, a lot of the focus on talks about Amelia Earhart, talk about her disappearance and what happened to her. But I kind of like thinking about, you know, what would have happened if that hadn't happened, you know,
yeah.
If she had actually made the flight or not gone on the flight at all or something like that.
Right.
You know, where would she be? What would she have done? And it's because it's amazing the influence she has now on people's drive and motivation. I mean, the Earhart Award and the CAP, on aviation in general, on women in aviation,
yeah.
And things like that. So, you know, through all the interviews you've done, I guess what are some thoughts you might have on that? You know, just what would have happened if we weren't here today and she was, you know, she'd made the flight successfully.
Gosh, excellent question. One only knows. The sky was really the limit for her. I think she could have done anything she wanted to do. She had that mindset. I think she would have probably at that point wanted to teach, not necessarily in the classroom, although she really loved her role at Purdue. I think that would have certainly continued. I really think she probably would have opened up an Amelia Earhart flight school and probably would have had a focus for women. I would be stunned if it didn't focus, you know, almost solely on women. I'm sure that she wouldn't have turned away men as well. But I think, you know, she probably would have had a major focus on just teaching women how to fly and kind of encouraging their passions. And if it wasn't aviation, if it was engineering or mathematics or whatever it was, really the early, early stages of STEM, what so many people are kind of talking about now. I think she was a major advocate of, and I think it's really sort of fun to speculate what she could have done, you know, and I think, you know, World War II coming along really kind of threw a monkey wrench in everybody's plans. And I think that would have changed a lot of things for her. She was really in a kind of an objector of war all the way back from when she worked as a nurse in Canada in World War I. She saw firsthand the military coming home with these horrific wounds, and I think at that point, right. You know, she knew she had to do something to help. So she decided to enlist and become a nurse. But she really kind of developed this hate for war. But, you know, it's interesting to see kind of how that kind of relationship that she had with, you know, with war and kind of how she felt about that would have kind of coincided with what would have happened with World War II and the women stepping up to run the country and the WASPs being created, which is, I think, something she would have been supremely proud of. So, you know, who knows? She, you know, her sister Muriel, I never had the honor of meeting Muriel, but Muriel lived a very long life. I imagine Amelia would have probably lived a very long life as well. And I think she would have created for herself an entire new set of contributions to the aviation community as a whole. I think she would have been proud to see kind of how aviation grew if she would have lived into her old age. And you know, it's one of those things that you just have to speculate on. What if, you know, what if Martin Luther King hadn't been shot? What would he have done? You know, what if Abraham Lincoln hadn't been assassinated? What would he have done? It's really kind of an interesting and fun, but also kind of tragic way to speculate on things. But it's not something that is lost on our guests. That's for sure. A lot of people love to speculate on what she could have done.
Yeah, it really speaks to the impact people can have on an entire civilization, because we've had so many really influential people in the past, especially women, and in that era, advancing the cause of women and you know, getting them recognized for their talents and what they're doing, and you know, all that stuff throughout the years, and how far along they could have been had she been able to, you know, to do that.
Definitely.
So I want to go back to actually you brought up her enlistment, and then you know, kind of her distaste for war and all that stuff. One of the recent episodes I heard on your podcast, Chasing Earhart, was a gentleman talking about that and talking about some of the theories, potential. Well, I don't know if they're theories. You maybe shed some light on this, but some of the ideas that maybe, you know, she was working with the military, or she made a comment about being a spy or something
right.
So can you comment on some of that, about her interaction with that, and maybe what her motivation behind that, maybe preventing war? Maybe that's what she thought she was doing, if she indeed was part of
that. Yeah, it's a good way to look at it. You know, her interaction with, you know, the military and the United States government is kind of interesting, because she was, you know, really close with the Roosevelts, FDR and Eleanor especially. You know, she famously took Eleanor up for a flight over D.C. At one point, and she was going to teach Eleanor to fly when she got back. That was one of the things that she was going to do. And Eleanor and her were really close, and she was close with FDR. And of course, you know, GP was close with FDR. So I think, you know, you mix that with the fact that she was a subjector to war. I think, you know, it can go multiple ways, because if you look at some of the folks that we have on the show that talk about, you know, the various hypotheses that they're working, and really the Japanese capture hypothesis is such a massive umbrella. There's so many different avenues that are underneath that umbrella that are contained within. And one of them is her involvement, and, you know, whether or not she knew about it, whether or not she was excited about her involvement, or whether or not she was kind of doing it more so as a personal favor for the Roosevelts, who she was really close with. If that is the case, and that is indeed what happened to her, it's really kind of interesting to see how that comes about. You know, the first attempt that she had in flying, making the world flight, she famously ground looped the plane in Hawaii. And, you know, the plane had extensive damage, and it had to be, you know, the flight had to be delayed by several months so that they could repair the plane and get it back into working condition, flying condition. It's important to note that at the time, you know, her and GP sort of mortgaged their future on this entire world flight. This was their, you know, this was kind of a risk, a real kind of calculated risk, but a risk nonetheless, that they kind of mortgaged everything they had on. And, you know, it's interesting to note that after the plane was kind of ground looped and wrecked, it took 11 branches of the United States government to come in and actually fund this whole mission and get this plane back in flying order. You know, the plane was taken into a secret, kind of a hangar. It was a military hangar. And it was a plane that was, you know, it was being worked on by different aspects of people that were kind of putting it together. It was very kind of under hush hush. People couldn't see what was going on. So I think maybe it's kind of interesting to speculate that in the initial world flight attempt, that she may have been asked, may or may not have been asked, to do a personal favor. Hey, can you, you know, if we put some cameras in your plane, can you take some photos of the Marshall Islands, of the Pacific? It's an area that we haven't mapped, that we haven't had a chance to really get to. You know, can you do this for us? And maybe in the beginning she said absolutely not, because of her strong kind of objection to war. She didn't want to do any kind of have any part in that. And if they were in fact preparing for war, you know, she maybe didn't want to take a part in that. But maybe when the plane crashed and she wrecked the plane, at that point she kind of had to. You know, it was kind of a strong arm situation where they said, hey, you know, we're going to go ahead and put your plane back together and fund the rest of your trip, but you're going to have to do something for us, and this is what we want from you. Mm-hmm. And she may or may not have had to do it at that point. Again, this is all speculation. This is all based off of hypothesis and based off of work that a lot of great folks have been doing. But it's interesting to speculate how she would have felt about that personally. It kind of goes both ways. She was fiercely loyal to her friends and her family. And she really thought a lot of Eleanor and thought a lot of FDR. And it might have been one of those things that trumped her beliefs on war. It could have been, I really believe that if they can make it, you know, if they can make a difference in this and maybe prevent war, then maybe, and I can play a part in that, I might be willing to do that. We're never going to really know kind of the inner thoughts of Amelia and what she was thinking at that point, if that is in fact what happened. But it is interesting to speculate. A lot of people have been doing it, and I think they'll continue to do it for some time.
Okay. Well, you kind of alluded to this just now and then in the last segment. Before we really continue talking about, you know, where we go from there. Why don't you let our audience know what some of the most credible hypotheses are as to her disappearance and what happened on that flight? Because I know there's a there's a handful of them, and then some people might remember the History Channel documentary that came out last summer, which really brought it to the forefront again. And so why don't you talk about some of the most credible? I say the most credible because there's probably a lot of really wacky theories out there.
Yeah, well, the, you know, I think it's safe to say she probably wasn't abducted by aliens. So that's probably going to strike that right off the top. But I can tell you this, for us, it's a little bit different. And I get this question, you know, fairly often. There's really, you know, there's three major hypotheses. There's really only two major hypotheses, depending on who you talk to. Obviously, the most common one is, you know, we're going to talk about Occam's razor, is crash and sink. There's also there's not much of a sub hypothesis. There's a crash and float a little bit, where they might have floated for a little while and then eventually sank. But that's pretty much the United States government, even to this day, that's their explanation for what happened to Amelia Earhart. She vanished over the Pacific Ocean. She ran out of fuel. She crashed. She sank. And that's what happened. And the plane sitting in the bottom of the ocean. And then the other major one is one of the oldest ones out there. And that's known as the Japanese capture hypothesis. That's what we've dubbed it as, because it's just such a large scale hypothesis. And as I alluded to earlier, there are many sub hypotheses under that umbrella. So depending on what you believe happened to the Lockheed Electra Tinny, what you believe happened to Amelia and Fred, where they were taken, how they were treated, if and when they died on that island, and how long, you know, they were on that island before they died. There's a lot of kind of information on that particular hypothesis, as the Lost Evidence documentary kind of highlighted and spotlighted earlier this summer. And then there is the island castaway hypothesis, the Nikumaroro hypothesis, which you've had a little bit of experience with in talking to Dr. King. Tiger's been working on that hypothesis for approximately 30 years. They've done a lot of research and excavating on that island. They've you know, really kind of built a case built off of, you know, circumstantial evidence. You know, we talk about this all the time on the show. Building a case is like building a house, and Tiger has been building their house for 30 years. They've been really working on this steadily, building a kind of this living, breathing kind of, you know, case that people can kind of look at, and their transparency is second to none. Rick Gillespie and that, that team is, you know, everything they find, it's on their website. You know, you don't have to agree with it, but it's there, it's transparent. You can look at it, you can analyze it, you can make your own conclusions. And then they have there's another one that's kind of largely, I don't want to say panned, but it's just hasn't been given the due that I think it deserves. And that is known as the Irene Bolam hypothesis. And that is a very interesting and kind of, you know, exciting kind of hypothesis to look at, because it's the only hypothesis that actually shows her living, that she actually survives and lives. And I've kind of stated this before in past interviews, that if you look at the Japanese capture hypothesis and then you look at the Irene Bolam hypothesis, you look at them side by side, the only major difference in the two is that one she dies and one she lives. And it's kind of the way that she's kind of, you know, relocated back to the United States and is one of the original participants in what would become later known as the Witness Protection Program. So it's kind of, it's one of those things that it's when you look at it by itself, you know, it really, with all the forensic analysis that's been done on Irene Bolam and Amelia Earhart and the handwriting analysis and all the people that have gone to their grave knowing like they know that she was Amelia Earhart, it's an interesting hypothesis to look at. And I think it's one that really sort of warrants kind of a second look, if you will. And that's what our team is going to do. We're getting ready to do our Irene Bolam retrospective series. And we have some really interesting people that are going to be kind of involved, and some really powerful people that are going to really surprise a lot of people, I think, when they hear who's kind of involved in that particular retrospective. So those are the main hypotheses for us. And there are a couple of other ones. There's one known as the Buka hypothesis, which is being worked by a gentleman named William Snavely, Bill Snavely. He's done an incredible amount of research on it, and his I won't go into too much detail, but you can definitely hear it on our show, because he was a guest on our show. But essentially, the long and short of it is, he believed that they turned around when they realized that they couldn't make Howland, and they basically have a flight radius, and flight radius is how far you can fly on half your gas. And if you can't make your destination with the gas you have, or on half your gas, you turn around, because you're not going to risk crashing. And the idea here was that they turned around and they actually crash landed off Buka Island. And Bill Snavely, it's interesting. You think about that, and it kind of makes sense. You know, from a standpoint of, well, you would turn around if you didn't think you could make it. But when you look at the fact that out of all of the hypotheses that are being worked, he's the only one that actually has a plane. There is actually a plane sitting in less than 100 feet of clear blue Pacific off of Buka Island that can be investigated. Oh, wow. That can either be ruled out or it can be ruled in. And Bill, I love Bill's attitude because he's not saying, you know, he's not steadfast. He's not saying, yes, this has got to be it. There's no other option. He's a fan of everybody's work. He's a fan of everybody doing what they're doing. He's just simply saying there is a twin-tailed, nice, twin-engine plane that matches Amelia Earhart's plane. Size, scale, scope. It's sitting in less than 100 feet of water. It's buried in coral. Let's go rule this thing out if we can. If not, you know, let's investigate. And who knows if he's right, you know, he's done the math. It's very interesting to kind of listen to that episode of the show. So we're kind of giving that its due and kind of giving that some spotlight, but it's really just interesting, you know, to kind of see all these hypotheses and for the first time ever, perhaps, we're going to be really kind of giving everybody, the same platform to kind of work their hypothesis and put their data out there, untruncated and unargued by our team. We're not, our job is not to argue their, you know, their data. Our job is to sort of, just compartmentalize everything, put it out there and let other folks decide, you know, pick apart that data and decide if they're accurate, inaccurate, you know, if it's plausible, not plausible. That's not for us to decide. It's just kind of what we're doing. So more, you know, smarter people than us are doing that part of it. Our job is just to kind of present all this really kind of like a jury trial case. It's a jury of public opinion. That's what I always say. People get to put it out there and, you know, you decide what you believe. So.
What you're deep in this like almost no one ever has been.
That's both exciting and sad doing at the same time.
No. What do you personally believe?
You know, it's a question I get all the time, and everybody always asks me what you believe, what I believe, and I truly say I don't know yet, and people say that's a cop out, but really it's one of those things. It's like you know, we still got 2 full years to shoot. We have so many people to talk to yet. I am one of those people that I really love inductive reasoning. I like to see everything. I want to see the entire puzzle. I remember doing puzzles with my dad when I was a kid, and my dad would say, look, you know, it's a 1500 piece puzzle. We can do 1499 pieces, but until we have that, add that 1500th piece, the puzzle's not complete. So I'm one of those people that I got to see it all. I want to see everything that you put on the table, and then I can kind of dismiss what I want to dismiss. And I think we haven't even touched it yet, believe it or not. It seems like it's a really deep dive so far, and I'm really happy with the progress we've made. But we're just not there yet. It's interesting that to say this, but when people, it's like those people who test new cars. One of our project guests, Forrest Burgess from Astonishing Legends, puts it perfectly. These people that test new cars, they get this car and it's like, oh, it's the best car ever. It's got everything. And then they get the next car they got to test. Like, oh, this is the best car ever. It's got everything. You can literally do that with every one of these hypotheses. You can look at it on its own without any other influence on anything else. And you can be convinced that this is exactly what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. That is until you put that away and you put the next one down and you look at that one. So it's one of those things where I think everybody's in that boat. And they just have to be convinced. And I think I would be happy to give my thoughts, but I want to wait till it's finished.
Mm-hmm. Well, you may not have a strictly scientific background, but you're definitely thinking like a scientist, and that's great.
Yeah, we try. So, we try.
I like that. It helps keep you impartial and unbiased when you're doing the documentary, and gives it a lot more credibility, I think. Because even if you had a personal pet theory that, you know, this one is correct, you wouldn't even know it, but it could be influencing your decisions and questions in other ways. And the fact that you're keeping open minded about it is really awesome from just a journalistic standpoint as well. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We have to do that. With that, right. That's the very foundation of the project. If we don't do that, the project fails.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Well, we are going to take our final break, and then we'll be back to wrap up this discussion with Chris Williamson about Amelia Earhart in just a minute.
I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm the host of the Heritage Voices podcast. Heritage Voices focuses on how CRM and heritage professionals, public employees, tribes, and descendant communities can best work together to protect their heritage through tribal consultation, collaborative ethnography, and indigenous archaeology. Now back to the show.
All right, we're back on episode 34 of the Archaeology Show, and we're talking with Chris Williamson about Amelia Earhart. And I want to back up just a little bit, because I think you may have mentioned this in the first segment, but you, Amelia Earhart is from Atchison, Kansas.
Yes.
And you guys actually moved there, I think it was last summer. which is serious dedication to the project.
Yeah.
But what what's still in Atchison? What caused you to want to move there? Is it just being in the place where she grew up, or is there, I know there's a museum there and some other things, but what's this done for you?
Oh, it's been hugely helpful for the creative process. We wanted to bookend phase one of the project in Atchison at the Amelia Earhart Festival. They have a festival here. There was their 21st festival this past summer in July. And they celebrate the life and the legacy of Amelia Earhart. And it's Atchison's a town of 11,000 people approximately. And every year, you know, triple and quadruple that amount in July descend on Atchison for the Amelia Earhart Festival. They have this huge concert at Lake Fest here right on the Missouri River. They have the most incredible fireworks show you've ever seen. And on Saturday is the day where they have all the panels and they have the author signing, and it's all about Amelia Earhart, and they do a birthday cake for it and everything. It's a really kind of a neat thing. Atchison does a wonderful job of keeping the soul and spirit of Amelia Earhart alive. The two women who run it, Jackie Prejean and Karen Seberg, are just incredible women. They're good friends, and they've been exceptional as far as, you know, being able to put this on every year and do this. And you mentioned the Birthplace Museum. We happen to live about three blocks away from the room that Amelia Earhart was born in and the room that she grew up in. It's right on the bank of the Missouri River. So you can, if you're standing in Amelia Earhart's bedroom when she was a kid, look out her window and you can see the Missouri River. And she has these windows that opened up, and you can imagine that she probably sat on the roof, you know, all the time. Just kind of looking at the Missouri River and everything. They've also got Grace McGuire's Lockheed 10 Electra E, which is the last remaining Lockheed 10 Electra E in the world. And it's out here at the Amelia Earhart Airport that's actually being redeveloped and redesigned. They're creating an entire new museum around Muriel, which is the name of the plane. And, I saw that plane for the first time in July, and it takes your breath away because it really... Hmm. You know, this is the plane that Amelia Earhart flew in. It's identical down to the rivet. It's pretty incredible to see that. And, you know, they have Trinity Church where she was baptized here. They have the International Forest of Friendship, which is sort of like the Amelia Earhart Hall of Fame. It's kind of people get, you know, inducted into the Forest of Friendship every year, every September, I believe. It's just kind of people who demonstrate the spirit and the soul of Amelia Earhart and what she stood for. And they've also got, the city itself. You drive around the city and you'll see kind of graffiti style quotes painted on walls of Amelia Earhart in here. You'll see, kind of Amelia Earhart statues all around the city. I've always maintained this, and I still do. Amelia Earhart is still America's sweetheart, but she is definitely Atchison's daughter. She's Atchison's girl. And it's really kind of for us to be here. It's really beautiful for the creative process because we can kind of get, you know, ourselves in the mindset when I'm writing interviews, or again, it's like one of those things I was telling you about passion, 1 o'clock in the morning or whatever, and you're up writing interviews and you're exhausted and you're tired and you're like, you know, this is the place you want to be. If you want to be creative and if you want to do this, it's not unlike, you know, a writer who, if you're this, you know, a writer that's going to write a mystery thriller or something that's going to take place in Alaska, they'll move themselves to Alaska while they're writing the book. Just to sort of kind of get in that ambiance and put themselves in that environment. And that's really not unlike what we've done here. And luckily, my wife and my son love it here. And it's something that we cherish every day. And, we're going to be putting on this really incredible panel in July that we just kicked off promotion for. And matter of fact, we're going to be announcing the third guest for the panel tomorrow. Ever since we initiated that promotion, it's been 100 miles an hour, and it probably will be until July, until the panel comes out. It's really exciting to be here. So I really wouldn't want to be anywhere else but Atchison for this project. It just wouldn't do it justice, I don't think.
And are there any descendants of Amelia Earhart and her family still living? I know she didn't have any children herself, but are there any descendants still living in the area?
Well, a lot of her cousins, her extended family, they live in different areas. There's not anybody, this descendant of Amelia Earhart that lives directly in Atchison that I know of. I could be incorrect on that. We're still learning things. We just moved here in September, so we're still learning things as we go. but nobody directly related to Amelia Earhart, but again, I could be wrong on that. A lot of her family, some of her cousins and stuff are in Southern California. Her niece, Amy Kleppner, who is a project guest and an absolute doll, she is Muriel's daughter and, of course, Amelia's niece. She's in Texas. And, you know, she's going to be on the show pretty soon. Nice. And, yeah, so she's got a really incredible, you know, recollection of Amelia, and of course her mom. And we're doing an episode dedicated to Muriel with her. And, we'll probably ask her a little bit about Amelia in the episode, or maybe have her back. But Amelia's family, is kind of scattered all about, you know, she's got some extended mm-hmm. cousins and things that are kind of in different areas, but, yeah, it's really just her soul and her spirit are in Atchison, I think.
Nice. That's really cool.
Yeah.
All right. So back to the research a little bit. Has your research into Amelia Earhart and in your team's research produced anything new or really connected any new dots that people hadn't looked at before? Because the closer you look at these patterns, the more things start to line up sometimes.
Yeah.
But sometimes that can be just your brain wanting to make associations.
Yeah, confirmation bias.
And sometimes, exactly. And sometimes it's real. So have you guys made any really new groundbreaking research into this? Or are you kind of just in recording mode of everything that's out there?
I think it's a little bit of both. We have kind of, what's interesting for us is we hear a lot of wonderful stories about Amelia Earhart, and we just released an actual video. It's on our website of a young kid who met Amelia Earhart in Burbank mm-hmm. when he was a little kid. He was 4 years old when he met her, and he's still alive to this day. Wow. And he met her, and we actually had him do a little commentary on the video, and he actually gave us the original. He gave it to Douglas Westfall, who's a national historian, one of our project guests, and Douglas Westfall donated to Chris Evan Films for us to donate to the new museum out here in honor of Bethany Root, who tragically passed away last year after the Amelia Earhart Festival. And so we're doing that. But this particular video is a kind of a new story, has never really before been seen. Except by just a handful of people. And it really kind of showcases, it takes place around March 3, 1937, right before she takes off for Hawaii, where she ground loops the plane, which is what we talked about earlier. And it's kind of a new, fresh story that nobody's really heard. So we've kind of uncovered a lot of little tidbits and stories along the way in that nature. As far as the research is concerned, I think where we've kind of been a benefit for a lot of folks is collaboration and being kind of a liaison and really kind of mm-hmm. trying to be a catalyst for change within the Earhart community, because so many people, it's like, you know, with any great mystery, there's always camps. There's always these different camps that, you know, work together and kind of believe a certain hypothesis or whatever. We're trying to sort of put all of the data out there and compartmentalize everything and present it and possibly get folks to maybe work together that are open-minded, that can share, you know, their research and put everything on the table. And maybe, you know, it's always two heads are better than one. And I think if you're coming at it from a different aspect, it truly helps. And if we can be kind of the liaison for that to happen, we're blessed to be able to do that. And I think that's starting to show now. We're starting to see people that are kind of ringing me up and saying, hey, I reached out to so-and-so, or can you put me in touch with so-and-so? And I'm sitting here thinking, wow, what, really? Like, I thought you didn't, you know, but here, hey, great. You know, we'll put you in touch and we'll make it work. And so we're allowing that to kind of happen through our project, which is kind of really awesome. And, you know, I think really kind of shining the spotlight on some of the different hypotheses, like the Buka hypothesis that Bill Snavely's working, and like the Irene Bolam hypothesis that's been worked for a long time, but not given its proper due. I think that does uncover new stuff, and it covers, you know, it gets more people involved, and it uncovers new information because we dive deeper than most any group does. And so because of that, I think, you know, and you probably can speak to this too, when you're researching something, the deeper you dive, the more likely it is that you're going to uncover something. And so for us, mm-hmm. that's kind of the case we're trying to make here. And I think it's been starting to showcase through. We were also recently in CBS San Francisco, and I got a chance to look at Fred Gerner's files that had never before been seen by, again, maybe only a handful of people. I watched this, the lady at CBS San Francisco actually take these things off, and the dust is just, it's incredible. Like, it hasn't been seen for years. And we're trying to get that information released to us to be used in the Chasing Earhart project. And a lot of that, while we'll have to go through it, it's boxes and boxes and boxes of papers and just notes and scribble and just whatever. And God only knows what could be in there. I know he was, I did learn that he was in the middle of, he was going to write a second book. You know, I just, who knows what that would have contained.
Elaborate on Fred Gerner just real quick, because that's not a name a lot of people probably know associated with Amelia Earhart that aren't deep into the Amelia Earhart lore. Who is he, and what did he do in connection with her?
So Fred Gerner was a correspondent at CBS San Francisco in the 60s, and very, very, you know, well-known news guy, very well respected. And, you know, when the original story came out for the crash and sink, which was what the United States government, you know, stated that had happened to her, he just felt like something wasn't right. And he started kind of investigating, as journalists do. And he came upon his research took him to the island of Saipan, Marshall Islands. And he was really the pioneer of the Japanese capture hypothesis. He was the man that kind of blew the doors wide open on everything. And he did research, you know, and talked to so many different people over there. And he made a lot of connections, a lot of friends, including Admiral Chester Nimitz, who is one of the most highly respected admirals to this day still in the history of the military, yeah. who you know, had told him reportedly that, you know, hey, you're onto something here. I can tell you that, you know, she was here in the Marshall Islands, her and her navigator. So he kind of just kind of took the ball and ran with it, and really kind of created a whirlwind of research that trickles to this day, that people still talk about to this day, as we all experience with the lost evidence. Everything that was in the lost evidence, you know, it can be traced back to Fred Gerner's research, and he really is the pioneer of all that. And so he's, for that reason, he is an Amelia Earhart research icon, and he's going to be honored as in our icon series that we have that we do for the podcast alongside you know, Leo Bellarts and Paul Rafford, and of course Joe Jervis, who we're getting ready to do with the Irene Bolam thing. So it's mm-hmm. one of those situations where he was just one of the guys that pioneered everything for the Japanese capture hypothesis. He's the one that kind of started this whole thing in the mid to late 60s. 66 was when his book came out, it just kind of it's a book. I mean, if you listen to our show. A lot of our guests that work the Japanese capture hypothesis or are familiar with the Earhart case in general say, I read Fred Gerner's book and that was what got me going. And you know, he's a pioneer for that reason. And he's a very well-respected man. So we're just trying to honor him as much as we can and honor the research as much as we can.
Okay. Now, yeah, I'm glad you brought up the podcast, because that's how I want to round out this interview, is talking about how people can find out more, get their weekly dose, because you release weekly, right?
Yeah, it was originally bi-weekly, and then it just got to be too much information, and people were demanding it weekly. You test the waters, and you know this too as well. You see kind of what's going to work and what's not, and we had such a great reception that we decided to move to weekly, and now it's what we're doing.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. So talk about the podcast a little bit for those that don't know about it. What kind of interviews do you have? You've got a couple of different types of series that you do on there, different types of shows. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, the podcast is really my baby. That was the original idea for the project, and it still stays. It's the backbone of the project, I think. It's our constant data feed every week while we're shooting this documentary. And it's interview style. So every week I have a new guest from the project guest that's on the podcast. It could either be an archaeologist, as we did with Tom. It could be a scientist. It could be someone who's in aerospace. It could be someone that's affiliated with NASA. It could be an author. It could be a historian. And we're having some really interesting people coming up on the podcast. As a matter of fact, I'm going to sit down with Brad Meltzer on Tuesday, which is a really exciting thing. And Jessica Cox on Saturday, who's a really motivational, inspirational woman. We basically just interview people and kind of ask them about we start out with the most basic questions, which is, you know, tell us a little bit about your background in education so people can kind of understand where they come from. And then we ask them the all important kickoff question, which is, how did Amelia Earhart come into your life? And that's always a great question to start, because it just gets people kind of, you know, it's a different answer every time. Everybody comes to Amelia for something different. And it's really interesting to kind of get that kind of perspective. And we do the icon episodes. So every so often we do an icon episode, which is someone who really kind of exemplifies Amelia Earhart lore and legend and research, or someone who was a part of the story. We just did a 3-part retrospective series with Chief Leo Bellarts, who was the radio man on the Itasca, who was the last person to speak to Amelia Earhart when she was saying those famous lines. I'm on the line 157337. She was saying them to Leo. And we did earlier, we did a icon interview with Paul Rafford Jr., who wrote Amelia Earhart's radio, who was an incredibly gifted radio man and probably one of the most knowledgeable radio men on the planet, if not the most. So we have the icon episodes kind of sprinkled in there. And, you know, we're going to start doing some panel style interviews. We're going to be doing an interview pretty soon with children's authors that just kind of talk strictly about Amelia Earhart's impact on children. and why she's so relevant today and why people, young kids, still kind of, you know, dress up as Amelia Earhart at 9 years old still. There's a reason right. behind that, and we're going to kind of talk about all that. We also have prosecutors, defense attorneys, people in the legal system that are on the show that assist us and assist our audience really in breaking down terms like circumstantial evidence, smoking gun, anecdotal evidence. They talk about how you build a case, how you present it to a jury, how that process works. What constitutes as proving a case beyond a reasonable doubt? How do you fail to prove a case? All that great stuff. So people that are young, because we have a lot of young people that follow the project, can kind of sort of follow along. And when they hear these terms, they know exactly what those terms originate from and how they are. So it's really kind of an educational experience. It's something that the listener can follow along with the whole journey. And they can dive as little or as deep as they want with us, with our team. And, you know, that's kind of the podcast in a nutshell. It releases weekly. It can be found pretty much everywhere you can think of that a podcast can be found. We're on iTunes and Google Play, obviously. We're actually going to be the featured podcast on Podbean, which we're real excited about. That's nice. Going to kick off on the 19th. So for the folks out there who listen to your show that listen via Podbean or that have Podbean, if you go on the app, you'll see our banner up there. And then hopefully that'll get some more eyes on the project and get some more people to listen to the show. And we're going to keep going, man. We've recorded 36 episodes now. We just released episode 24, and we continue to record. Nice. I got 5 more episodes I'm recording this week. So we could truly stop recording the podcast for months and still release every week with no problem, which is good for us because sometimes I need to take a break because I'm shooting the documentary and it bleeds into the weekend. And sometimes we have promotion and things we can't record. So it's great to be able to just kind of get these episodes ready and get them out there for people to consume.
I'll tell you what, as a podcaster, there's no better feeling than having some in the bank. So you
I'm with you, man, 100% on that. It really, especially with what we're doing, because it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I tell people when I do interviews in media all the time that this Earhart project that we're doing, it's the best way I can sum it up is it's a terrible privilege. It really is. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things that we feel honored and blessed to do, but it's just, it's a lot of work. And, it hasn't been taken on in this aspect and this scale before. And we're happy to be able to do it. We're happy to be all in on this thing until it's out. And, you know, we'll be here. We'll be putting out content constantly. Our chat is, always, mm-hmm. almost always live on our website. People can go to chasingyourheart.com. Chances are if you ask something in the chat or if you go to chat with somebody, someone will probably respond to you. There's someone who monitors the site all the time for the most part. You know, our team is great. I can't push our team enough. They're so great. I'm just one person on the team, and I'm just kind of the monkey trying to keep up with everybody's interviews. And, you know, they're the real stars of the show, not me. I'm just kind of the guy that's unwittingly being thrown out in the spotlight to talk about everything.
Well, no, everybody that has organized something like this knows that no team would exist without somebody to organize them all into a cohesive thing to get something done. So what you're doing is really great. And I think that's an awesome note to end on. So check out all the links in the show notes. We have a bunch of stuff that Chris mentioned on the show here that I've been taking notes on that'll be in the show notes for this episode. And some of the things he mentioned have already happened, like some of the interviews are going to do, because you're listening to this a little bit in the future from when we're recording. So, definitely go check a lot of this stuff out. And thank you, Chris Williamson, for being on the show.
It's been my honor. Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song, I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.